So we read from Matthew's Gospel. As we find it in Matthew chapter 2, this should be a familiar passage. Look it up on your phones or your tablets or your pew Bibles. If you're looking up on your phone, we'll be reading from the New Living Translation. Reading from verse 1. After Jesus was born in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem. They asked, "Where is the one who is born to be king of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means the least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." The prophet Micah. And then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared, and he sent them to Bethlehem to go and search carefully for the child. "As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." And after they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. Note the word for child there does not mean baby. It means young child. And when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. And on coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him, and they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of... Well done. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. And when they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt and stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." Who's this? Albert Einstein. Well done. Who said that? Well done, guy. And are you a scientist? You're a mathematician. Okay. Albert Einstein, famous for the discovery of the theory of general relativity. And the theory of general relativity is what? E equals mc squared, where E is energy, M is mass, and C is the speed of light. So the amount of energy contained in any amount of mass is that mass multiplied by the square of the speed of light. Okay? You got that? All right. Thank you very much. You will be tested later. Next slide. Who's this?
Isaac Newton.
Thank you very much. Isaac Newton was a physicist as well, famous for Newton's laws of thermodynamics. Thank you. Can anybody quote any of the laws of thermodynamics? David? That's... Now, you're an art teacher, David, so I'm well impressed. You made good use of your Scottish education. Well, what goes up must come down. Now, okay. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And energy is preserved. Okay, so... Although it's illegal now, when you got smacked as a kid, the energy from your parents' hand was preserved as it contacted your behookie. As the hand stopped and your behookie absorbed the energy of the hand. Next slide. Who's this?
Graham Bell.
Not Darwin, though I can see why you might say that. And it's not Alexander Graham Bell, although... Spot on for the nationality. Does anybody know who this is? There are three great physicists. Perhaps Stephen Hawking will be added as a fourth. It's not Tesla, but a good guess. James Clark Maxwell. Well done, guy. This is James Clark Maxwell. Just hands up here if you ever heard of James Clark Maxwell. Wow. Five? Ah, brilliant. Do you know where James Clark Maxwell was born? He wasn't born in Pennycook. James Clark Maxwell was born in Edinburgh. I might add that Albert Einstein himself said there were two great physicists upon whose work his work rested in his theory of general relativity. One was Isaac Newton, and the other was James Clark Maxwell. James Clark Maxwell was born the son of a lawyer into a wealthy family, a wealthy Edinburgh family. He inherited in time an estate in Cuckooburyshire, which he was very fond of, and he was born James Clark, but he took the surname Maxwell as well in honor of the family that had gifted him this country estate. This is the James Clark Maxwell building at Edinburgh University, where I used to run around as a kid because my dad worked there. He worked there running a mainframe computer back in the day when computing services were strategically given out by the government through universities. And so the Edinburgh Regional Computing Center had its first big ICL mainframe in the James Clark Maxwell building. And so my English parents were drawn north in 1966 and came north to Edinburgh. And the first place was a leaky flat by the Water Leith down in Stockbridge. But they moved to West Savile Terrace, where I was born, and Dad worked at the James Clark Maxwell building. James Clark Maxwell was a remarkable man. This is the first color photograph ever taken by anybody. And James Clark Maxwell was able to do this because he surmised that there was all sorts of discussions about what light might be, but he had discovered, obviously, famously, light can be broken up by a prism into its constituent parts. But what are the primary colors of light? Red, blue, and green. Yeah, which is different from the primary colors of paint pigment, which is red, blue, and yellow. So he found that by splitting up an image into its red component, its blue component, and its green component, you could replace these over each other, and there you go, the first ever color photo was of a tartan ribbon. It's a good Scotsman. In 1857, well, he studied at Edinburgh and then went to Cambridge. And then in 1857, he was teaching in Aberdeen. And there was lots of speculation. One of the things that could be seen by the telescopes that we had at the time was that Saturn had rings. We now know that Uranus and Neptune also have rings, but Saturn has the most vivid rings of any planet in the solar system. And there was a lot of thought as to what might make up those rings. And there was discussion, was it a gas, was it fluid, or was it solid? And it was James Clark Maxwell who first figured out that it was impossible for it to be fluid or a gas, and posited that Saturn's rings were made up of thousands and thousands and thousands of what were, in comparison to the planet, tiny particles. That was confirmed by Voyager 2. You see, James Clark Maxwell was one of the first, he was really the first to think of light and electromagnetism as being the same thing. He was the first person to notice that they traveled at about the same speed, and he thought that coincidence was beyond coincidence, and was the first to try and draw together the theory of light and electromagnetism into a unified theory. Okay? I understand that. At that point, I start to lose track. But has anyone ever done the iron filings test with a magnet? So here's a dipole magnet, so it has a north and south pole. And as you can see, the filings form around either end of the magnet in rings. You see that? And Clark Maxwell was the first person to discover that those rings are fields. They do not have a start. They do not have an end. They just exist and exert a force on one another that's unseen until it has an effect on a physical object. So James Clerk Maxwell was someone who understood about hidden forces. He came up with 20 equations, and it was simplified by a guy, I think his name was Oliver Haynes after him, into 4 equations. Okay, I am not a graduate level physicist, so I do not have a clue what these mean. I can tell you that one of them is called Gauss's law. They are to do with electromagnetism, but this is where my knowledge and understanding fall off a cliff edge, and I feel just as thick as anyone. That guy figured it out just about the time these floorboards were being laid. He's a remarkable, remarkable man. But all you really need to know is that he was the first person to figure out that light, the things that we see, are really a form of electromagnetic radiation. And that leads to the possibility of radio communications. So the mobile phone that you have in your hand, television, radio, radar, the idea that you could transmit over distance, all of that is only possible because it's understood that there are unseen forces all around about us that give us that facility. And that is why we understand that there's a mobile phone mast that can communicate with our phone. Or, as you may know, 3 mobile phone masts that communicate with your phone because they can figure out where you are. That's how it does it, by the way. It just understands how far you are from each of these 3. The internet would be impossible. And, of course, Einstein's great insight that mass and energy and the speed of light were all connected, that the universe was governed by rules, that would have been impossible. Right. You've now heard of James Clerk Maxwell. Why am I telling you this? Has anybody come across the notion in recent days that science and religion are at war? That you'll get an atheist scientist, something of that nature, and who will say, well, you know, it's made up God, made up stuff. We have science. We don't need God. Anyone come across that argument? Okay, maybe at school. Maybe, well, see, Andy's got his hand up, maybe in the taxi cab. Yeah. Cool, how are you doing? How are you doing today? Oh, well, you know, I was praying. Ah, it's an imaginary God. We've proved God doesn't exist. No, we have not. Science can say remarkable things about stuff. It really can. It can explain to you how those people who are important to you are made up. We know an extraordinary amount about the chemical makeup of everybody sat here. We understand how to fix in certain situations bodies, though there are limits to our understanding. We understand how things fit together. We have an extraordinary amount of knowledge. In fact, we have so much knowledge now that the smartest, even the smartest people in our midst can't know everything there is to know. That up to about the 1700s, you could be that person who knew everything there was to know that we discovered so far, there or thereabouts. But understanding how the people you love are chemically made up tells you nothing about why they're here and what their meaning is and the love that you feel for them. Am I right? There is far more to say about this world than science is able to say. Those of you who have done the Alpha course in the past few years will have seen Francis Collins, who was one of the scientists in charge. He got the Nobel Prize because Collins and his associates were able to decodify the human genome. All the pairs, millions and millions and millions of pairs of code in your that's in every cell in your body. But it was talking to a terminally ill lady in hospital that taught him that he needed more than that. So in an age where religion and science are seen as opposite, James Clerk Maxwell was a man who loved Jesus. He loved Jesus. And he saw his work as an expression of worship. And as we've been going through this series through Advent, and really through this year, all the looking at those stories from the workplace that Mark Green told, those stories about the hairdresser who was praying for her clients as she washed their hair, or the couple who enjoyed their bus journeys because they were always praying they'd have someone to talk to about their faith, about people who are learning to bring Jesus into negotiations or into when they meet their boss and have their annual review. If Jesus is real and he is risen from the dead, if the Christ child in the manger is the one on whose life we now depend, our old life having been put to death, then all life is an expression of worship. And James Clerk Maxwell saw his work as an expression of worship. When he looked at Saturn's rings, he didn't just look at a physical object. Any more than when he looked at his wife, he was looking at a physical object. He was looking at something in the heavens that declared the glory of God. And you know how we know that? Well, one, he told us. But two, Clark Maxwell had a favorite hymn. He had a favorite hymn. It's actually a hymn, I'm not sure we've sung this. You'll see that this hymn was written by Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was just about a contemporary of James Clerk Maxwell's, which is a reminder that all the stuff that is old to us was new to someone who went before us, yes? And so just in the same way that for many of you over this Christmas season, So Will I has kind of struck a chord, so this hymn struck a chord for James Clerk Maxwell. And it's astonishing, did you notice as we sung it, that it's talking about the meaning of creation. That through the physical things in creation, the sun, moon, and stars, the rainbows, in all of the things around about us, we see God's hand at work. And indeed, it speaks to us of what God does in our life too. And that wonderful line, grant us thy truth to make us free and kindling hearts that burn for thee. Isn't that something? It's just wonderful. So I just want to reflect on the wise men for a bit. Now, the wise men were astrologers. We know they were astrologers. Many ancient scientists were astrologers back in the ancient world. The distance between astrology and astronomy was almost non-existent. People observed the movement of the heavens. They had been doing this for thousands of years, and indeed we have some records. Some of the earliest records we have of human activity at all are records of the positions of the stars. Indeed, we see in ancient architecture in places like Stonehenge and things like that, maps of the moving of the celestial bodies. And of course, the Bible warns against astrology, but just because the Bible warns against something doesn't mean that God can't somehow get through to somebody through that. I'm reminded that, Cammie McKenzie was a young lad from Fergusley Park in Paisley. Figgy Park, to those who come from the district. And he was a tearaway and eventually got tied up in gangs and went to prison for attempted manslaughter. It would have been murder if the ambulance had got there about 20 seconds later, reckoned the paramedic. Though in Cammie's defense, he'd been attacked first. Cammie's a minister. And he was first approached by, I think it was his hairdresser actually. And his hairdresser, who's an astrologer, said, you need to read the Bible. And he went, really? So he read the Bible, became a Christian, then went back to his hairdresser and said, I've read the Bible and it says that you're barking up the wrong tree. So the wise men have come from the east, and in a way that they could understand, God had communicated to them that an event of some significance had taken place. And they saw that declared in the heavens. Those of you who are aware of ancient mythology will know that this is not a surprise. That's often the case. Even the mighty Disney choose to start off their films with a picture of a fairy tale castle and then a heavenly body going across the top. And even if it's Tinkerbell doing sky graffiti, we know what's meant by that, don't we? That there's something about the heavens that invites us to think about whether there's a God. The fact that the ancients talked about God's residence being up, and we must understand that the Hebrew Bible was written with an understanding that the earth was one sphere, below there was the waters, above there was the waters, and it was the sphere of the heavens that kept all of that chaos at bay. God found a way to get through to them. And at the end of their journey, they found who? They found Jesus. Perhaps the most extraordinary thing about the story of the Magi is they were so convinced as to the veracity of their calculations and their travels that when they finally were confronted with the Christ child, they recognized that this was the one who was promised to be born the King of the Jews. And they weren't Jews at that manger side, not this lot. Although I say manger side, as I said, the word for child there is actually a youth. So there may have been some passage of time, even though we kind of compress Luke and Matthew into a nativity that's suitable for our mantelpieces, where the shepherds and the magi turn up and we figure out what side to put them on. This was a later visitation. And there's been various thoughts. Was it Halley's Comet? Was it the divine glory of God that glowed blue above the Ark of the Covenant that we read about in David's day as the Ark was brought into Jerusalem? Who knows? It'd be fun to find out. I dare say, he used to say the videotapes will be available in glory, but then we'll just watch the data. But who knows? It'll probably be holographic stuff that comes out your jacket by the time we actually get to glory ourselves. Such is the pace of technology. Let's tie all this together. James Clerk Maxwell was able to take his intellect, which was given to him by whom? By that same Jesus. And use it for the betterment of humanity. That's part of our worship. Is to use the skills and the ingenuity and the insight that we have been given for His glory. Yeah? A friend of mine had an old, he had a tape that tells you how long ago it was, by Pastor something or some such, I can't, but he was an old blues harp player from the Deep South who did gospel tunes on his harmonica. And one of his tunes was, I ain't been to seminary, I've been to Calvary. And I get his sentiment. I get that. Paul says in 1 Corinthians, our intellect can trip us up. The whole idea of Jesus is a stumbling block to those Greeks. They can't figure it out, you know, and it's scandal to the Jews and to the Greeks. The religious people don't like him. The intellectual, philosophical people don't like him. But let me ask you a question. Do you think Paul for one moment disregarded the gifts that he'd been given? As we've wandered through these last 2 years, through Romans and Acts, did Paul use what God had given him for the betterment of those around him? Yes, he did. And actually, arguably, Paul riffing off of what Jesus had left, manages to draw together between Jesus, who's like the composer, as Tom Wright would say, and Paul, who's like a conductor, they answer every significant philosophical question that was raised in 1,000 years of Greek thought. In a book that thick. The intellect that God has given us is a gift. I am looking forward to the first intellect that's able to harness the power of nuclear fusion. We're close. Who here has heard of a tokamak? Tokamak? A tokamak is a pressure vessel that uses electromagnetic forces to contain what happens in the sun. Who discovered electromagnetic forces and their relationship? It was James Clerk Maxwell. If we get fusion right, that's going to be something. I'm looking forward to the person who figures out how we can cheaply desalinate water so that drinking water is no longer the subject of warfare but can be provided to the peoples of the world. I'm also rather keen to the people who are desertifying the desert, which can be done, as is evidenced, by the way, by what Israel has done since the establishment of Israel as a nation in 1948. Israel is unrecognizable from the Palestinian desert that was there before. And despite the troubles that are in that land, one of the things that is undeniable is that that land has greened. I'm looking forward to economists figuring out how even more people can be pulled out of extreme poverty. And I might tell you, by the way, that the goals that the United Nations set themselves for 2020 for pulling people out of absolute poverty were reached at 2012. According to Steven Pinker's research, 100,000 people are connected to the electricity grid every day, all over the world. There are amazing things happening. And God has given us our intellect and ability for the betterment of those around about us. Figure through gnarly, difficult problems. For example, how to bring the good news of Jesus Christ to the people of Middle Orient. Yeah? And I'm hoping we're involved in that one. While we also figure out how to make sure that nobody needs to go to bed hungry and that people have availability of modestly priced secondhand, lightly used secondhand goods and things of that nature. How we cohere as a community as people come in from all over the place. All of that stuff. God gave us our intellect for His glory and for the betterment of those around us. And as we use that, it's an act of worship. And one of the great successes of the enemy has in recent years been to persuade us that our intellectual work life is separate from our devotional life. It is not. It's all part of one and the same. And the last thought is this. If the stars were made to worship, yeah, so will I. So will I. We have extraordinary things to accomplish as a community, as people. But if we lose our moorings and fail to see where we fit into this world, it always goes wrong. And it's lovely to be reminded. You just have a look on the BBC website, all the stuff they have on James Clerk Maxwell. It's fab. It's just worth an afternoon's browse. And see how far you get with understanding his stuff. And by the way, if you can understand his four equations and explain them, I'll happily have you come up the front, and you'll have 5 minutes to do so. Oh, what was it? I recently heard someone say, if someone is incapable of explaining something to a child, then they don't really understand it. If the stars were made to worship, so will I. And I pray that as this year comes to a close, and as we have our celebrations tomorrow, and 2019 starts up, that our hearts would orient in worship towards the goodness and love and amazing grandeur of Jesus, who is not just the King of the Jews. He's the Savior of the cosmos. All of creation needed Jesus, for all of creation was put in place by him. And all of creation is broken through our rebellion, and all of creation will be repaired as his saving, redeeming, remaking, restorative work makes its way through the universe. Last thought. Some of you have got friends and family who are close to death. Very close to death. And you sit here this morning knowing that next Christmas they're not going to be here, in all likelihood. First of all, as a community, we want to extend our love and support to you. You know who you are. But second is this. We have a task in our life of worship to orient those around about us who do not have long in this world to introduce them to the one who can take them by their hand as they take their last breath here and step into his keeping. And that is an astonishing privilege. And I pray this year that we get a bit better at that. One of the great calls on the church is to give people a good death. And we've seen more than our fair share of it. A lot of us over the last year or two have lost parents and loved ones. But we are here for a while. But we are with him for eternity. And so let's make an impact here, a lasting impact with what God has given us. And may that expression of a life of worship be an encouragement to all of those round about us, especially those whose time is near. Amen? Let's pray.